7th District. I'm chair of the revenue committee and chair of this special committee. Committee was created just this past session pursuant to LR 155 to study Nebraska's tax system and make recommendations if necessary for any changes. I would like to ask each of the members of the committee to introduce themselves. We'll start with Senator Norquist on that.
Senator Jeremy Norquist from District 7, downtown South Omaha.
Pete Persh, District 4, Douglas County, portions of Omaha.
Burke Carr, District 8.
Kate Sullivan of Cedar Rapids, representing District 41.
John Harms, Scotts Bluff, the 48th District.
Tom Hanson from North Platte, representing all of Lincoln County, District 42.
Gail Hadley, the 37th District, Kearney, and the lower part of Buffalo County.
Paul Shoemaker, District 22, that's Platte, parts of Colfax and Stanton County.
Kathy Campbell, and I represent District 25, which is East Lincoln, and then northeast Lancaster County.
Charlie Jansen, I represent District 15, which is Fremont, and all of Dodge County.
Keith Mello, District 5, South Omaha.
Kate Bowles, District 29, South Central Lincoln.
Thank you all. The work of the committee is divided into two distinct parts. First are working sessions. These sessions are intended to provide committee members with important background information, an overview of Nebraska's existing tax system, and analysis of that system by national experts on tax policy, economics, and tax reform initiatives. Then we're going to have public hearings pursuant to LR 155. We will be conducting 5 public hearings around the state beginning September 23rd in Scotts Bluff. Public hearing schedule is available on the legislature's website. This will be the public's opportunity to voice their opinions as citizens about the structure of our state tax system. Each hearing will have an agenda with specific topics seeking public comment. In addition to dates and locations, the website will have further details about the hearings and how the public can participate. A report of the committee's work will be released in mid-December. We want the working sessions open to the public to provide as much transparency as possible to our work. Please note, however, that the working sessions are intended for just that working. The committee will not be accepting public testimony or any other form of public participation at the working sessions, including this one. Public testimony will be limited to the public hearings. If you'd like to submit comments or suggestions in lieu of testifying at one of these hearings, please mail or email them to my office. We have Dr. John Anderson with us. Dr. Anderson is a professor of economics at the University of Nebraska Lincoln College of Business. He holds the Baird Family Endowed Professor of Economics position at the university. He received his doctorate from Claremont Graduate School and his undergraduate degree from Western Michigan University. In addition to this role as a teacher, Professor Anderson has published a great deal of tax research and consulted with governments here and in other nations on the role of the property tax in public finance. He was also at one point in his career a treasury official with the state of Michigan. He is currently at work on a research report for the Lincoln Land Institute, an internationally recognized source of information on property tax and land use issues. He may be able to discuss some of his preliminary findings today. His topic today we've asked him to address is the property tax. We've asked him to compare Nebraska's property tax structure that used in other states and make observations about the recommended structure for the property tax from his point of view. We are pleased that a national and internationally recognized expert on the property tax is part of our university faculty and delighted to have him present today. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for coming and being willing to share your thoughts with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator, and it's good to be here and talk about an important tax in our portfolio of taxes here in Nebraska. So I've prepared a presentation that should take some 40 minutes, and then we'll have time for Q&A along the way. If there are questions of clarification, I'd be happy to entertain those, but we'll leave most of the questions for the latter part, and I'd be happy to go back at that point and talk in further detail about things as we go along. I believe you're getting a handout here of 4 tables that I will talk about relatively early in my presentation. But let me give you, first of all, an overview of property taxes in Nebraska compared to other states. This is part of my chart this morning. And let me suggest that there are 3 ways that you might look at property taxes in Nebraska compared to other states. you could look at property taxes paid in the state per capita, that is, per person in the state of Nebraska, and compare it to other states. This would give you an idea of the overall level of property taxation on a per capita basis. That is one point of comparison. Secondly, you could look at property taxes as a share of personal income. This scales property taxes relative to the income that people earn and gives you a measure that is somewhat more nuanced in the sense that it shows you property taxes relative to people's ability to pay them. And thirdly, you can look at property taxes as a share of general revenue, either at the local level exclusively or combined state and local property taxes, as state property taxes are important in some states, not so much here in Nebraska, but other states have state property taxes as well. So this gives you an idea of property taxes and the reliance that the state places on that tax source for its general revenues. So let me just move ahead and show you the first chart, which is local property taxes per capita. This is data from the U.S. Census Bureau 2011, just recently published. This is the latest available data. And I've given you the 50 states here, including the District of Columbia as well. And again, this is local property taxes per person in the state in 2011. And for convenience, I've made Nebraska red, so you can pick it out. We're right just over $1,500 per person in Nebraska, and you can look across the chart and see how we compare to some other states. I've highlighted our neighboring states in green so that you can see what the neighboring states do. So Colorado, Iowa, Kansas, and South Dakota are in green. First thing you'll notice is that we're not among the very highest property tax states by this measure. That distinction goes to the District of Columbia, to Connecticut, to New Jersey, to New Hampshire, Rhode Island, places like that where property taxes per person run as high as nearly $3,000. We're in the $1,500 range, and if you compare our level of taxes by this measure to neighboring states, we're slightly below Colorado, which is at $1,654, slightly above Iowa and Kansas, which are both in the $1,400 range, plus or minus, and a little bit higher above South Dakota, which is about $1,200. But by this measure, we're fairly comparable to our neighboring states. Certainly, we're not like Arkansas, Alabama, Kentucky, and New Mexico and Oklahoma, which are very low property tax states. But by this measure, we're not among the highest. We're in that second tier at around $1,500 per person. The second table shows you the second measure by which you might judge property taxes. And this is the measure that scales property taxes paid relative to personal income. So here I took the Census Bureau data on property taxes, and I took the personal income data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis and simply computed the ratios and report them as percentages here. So in this case, you'll see that Nebraska is just below 4%. So property taxes paid here in the aggregate in Nebraska are roughly 4% of all the personal income that's earned in the state as well. Once again, we're not among the very highest property tax states. New Jersey, New Hampshire, South Carolina, which is mistakenly shaded green here, that should be South Dakota that's green. Nonetheless, we're in the 4% range when the highest states are over 5, approaching 6% in the case of New Jersey. So look at comparable states. Colorado is just a hair below 4%. Iowa and Kansas are, Iowa's about 3.8%, Kansas is about 3.5%, and South Dakota is just over 3%. So we're roughly comparable to our neighboring states by this measure. Once again, we're not like Arkansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Vermont, because we rely more heavily on the property tax as a source of funding for local governments than those states do. Now, I would also caution, when you look at a measure like this one, you need to be careful. This is a ratio, and the ratios can differ either because the numerators differ or the denominators, right? And so you've got to take into account the fact that we're looking not only at property taxes paid here, but we're also looking at income. So this ratio could be high or low depending on whether income is high or low relative to other states, as well as whether property taxes are high or low relative to other states. In that regard, Nebraska ranks pretty much in the middle of the distribution of the 50 states by way of per capita personal income. I computed that, and we rank 22nd from the top, so approximately in the middle. South Dakota, Kansas, Iowa are all quite similar in the 20s. South Dakota ranks 21st, Kansas 24th, Iowa 28th. Colorado has a higher income per capita. They rank 13th in the country. So caution with a measure like this, but still I think it's a useful measure because it scales property taxes relative to income and gives you some idea of burden relative to ability to pay. The third measure comes in two variations. This is the state and local property taxes as a share of state and local owned source general revenue. So here I'm combining state and local property taxes, dividing by state and local owned source general revenue. So these are the revenues that are generated by governments. Owned source means these are their own revenue sources. This nets out transfers from higher levels of government. So intergovernmental transfers are not here. These are the revenues that are raised by these state and local governments themselves. So it's a cleaner measure for you to consider. In this case, Nebraska is just below 25% at 24.7. So we get about a quarter of state and local owned source revenue from the property tax. Again, the high states, according to this measure, are New Hampshire, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and so on. Our neighboring states, Colorado is just below 25%. Iowa and Kansas are in the 21 to 22% range. And South Dakota is just below 24%. So we're quite comparable to neighboring states according to this measure. The national average, by the incidentally, is 22.5%. So we're in that same ballpark as the national average. Now, the next chart shows you the local property tax as a share of local owned source revenue. So this gives you a picture of how reliant local governments are in the various states on the property tax for funding. Here we're just over 50%, 50.8%. The national average is 47.5% approximately. So we're very close to the national average. The high reliance states are Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and so on. So we're not in that tier of states that rely on the property tax at the local level to the extent that states like those rely on it for 75 or 80% of their own source revenue. We're in the next tier of states down around 50%, so roughly half of the local revenue is coming from the property tax. Again, the national average is about 47%. Colorado's at roughly 43%, Iowa's close to 49%, Kansas 46%, and South Dakota is close to 52%. So comparing the neighboring states, we're quite similar according to that measure as well. So that gives you three different ways to think about property taxes in Nebraska and how we compare to other states. Each of these measures has their strengths and weaknesses depending on exactly what it's measuring, and the interpretations of these numbers would be nuanced by the very definitions themselves. So keep that in mind as you look at tables like this. I would also caution that the reason I've shown you bar charts here is that you can look at all 50 states. Sometimes if you look at rankings, what happens is you find states that are clustered that are very similar have different rankings. The rankings can be as much as 5 to 10 points different, and it gives the appearance that the measures are quite different. But these are just ordinal rankings from top to bottom, and This shows you how Nebraska compares, and you can see that there may be a cluster of states that are actually quite similar to one another, and you wouldn't want to make fine distinctions on the basis of those small differences between them. So just a word of caution, if you're looking at similar data that's in the form of ranking these kinds of measures, be careful about those rankings. They sometimes exaggerate the extent to which states differ from one another. Let me move on for my second point to talk more broadly about the role and purpose of the property tax system for some context here about then talking about the design of a property tax system as well. So let me just remind you the basics that the property tax is the primary own source revenue source for local government units, especially school districts, but also cities, counties, and other local units, as you're aware. It's an essential element of a decentralized fiscal system. As mentioned in the introduction, I've done a lot of work internationally, and decentralized systems like ours differ quite markedly from centralized systems, where the central government delivers services at the local level, but the local units have no tax bases of their own, no ability to choose their own tax rates. In our system, it's decentralized, and the key aspect of decentralization is the local governments have their own tax bases. They set the rates themselves independently of the central government. And the reason for that, of course, is that it aligns the desires of the local residents and voters with their willingness to pay for the local public goods and services. And it's that alignment that we believe makes a decentralized system operate in a superior way to a centralized system, so that the people in the local community get what they want and what they're willing to pay for. And over time, people can sort themselves out across communities to find the kind of community they would like to live in, especially in urban areas where there are many choices available to them. In terms of the design of a property tax system, of course, the underlying motivation of a property tax system is that the local public services provided to the community residents are valuable, right? People like to live in a good quality school district, and being in a good quality school district enhances the value of their property. And so as a result, the residents should be willing to support the provision of those public services if they find them valuable. So property taxes are used because they have both benefit and ability to pay aspects to them. The benefit side of it is that the public services that are given to the residents or provided increases the value of their property, and so they should be willing to pay for those benefits in proportion to the value of the property that they own. This goes way back to colonial times when property taxes were initially implemented, and the recognition that local public services actually provided direct benefits to those who were vested in the community, who owned property in the community. The ability to pay side of it comes from the recognition that the property tax is a tax on wealth, and the property tax is therefore based on a resident's ability to pay. Now, this isn't a comprehensive measure of wealth. This is only property wealth, but it's one form of wealth, and it is a kind of measure of their ability to pay, and that's an important underlying principle as well. Now, let me make a bit more distinction about this idea that the property tax is a tax on wealth, because I often hear questions that it's a tax on property, it's not a tax on income, as if an income tax would be preferable or superior. So let me make a distinction between the economic concepts of a stock and a flow. A stock measure in economics is a measure of an absolute quantity of something, in this case, a stock of wealth. And of course, there are flows into that stock and flows out of that stock, right? You can think of a tank of water that's got a faucet letting water in and a drain letting water out. And the flow of income coming in makes the stock larger. The flow of income or expenditure going out diminishes the stock. And so when we're talking about a property tax, we're talking about a tax on the stock of wealth here. We're not talking about a tax on income, although it's very clear that the two are related. Income and wealth are related to one another. The flow of income ultimately determines determines the stock of wealth, the flow of net income, income minus expenditures. If you think about this using the simplest possible formula, the perpetuity formula, the value of an asset, V, is R divided by I, where R is the net rent or the net income earned each year. I is the discount rate you use to discount for the time value of money, reflecting the opportunity cost of capital. And so the value of an asset is related to the net income it generates. That's the R term here. And so in discussions about the property tax, please keep in mind that it's a tax on property wealth, but that is also indirectly a tax on income because wealth is determined by the net rent that's paid by an asset like an acre of land or an apartment complex or any other real asset you can imagine. So you can tax this kind of asset either way you like. You can tax the value of the property or you can tax the income generated by the property. And there's an equivalence relationship between the two. If you care to think about the equivalence relationship between the two, I've given it to you here. T super R is the tax rate that would apply to the net rent or the income. T super V is the tax on the value of the property. And so as you have discussions about the property tax going forward, if you hear questions about why we're taxing property rather than taxing income, please keep this in mind. There is an equivalence relationship between the two, and the property tax is specifically designed to tax the value of property, not the income generated by the property, although the two concepts are clearly related to one another, and you could tax either way. Property taxes, though, are designed specifically to apply to the stock of wealth, not the flow of income. Okay. What's the ideal tax base that you could consider for a property tax? Given that you want the property tax, you've made that decision, what's the right tax base? Well, the gold standard in this regard is using market values for properties. Market values reflect the value of the property in a market context, assuming this is a competitive market where we've got buyers and sellers willing to exchange properties with one another for valuable considerations. We usually, when we talk about assessors and how they do this, they rely on so-called arm's length transactions. So they're looking at transactions where buyer and seller are not related to one another, where there's no kinship relationship, there's no excessive neighborly relationship, and so on. You want a clean transaction for trying to assess the value of a property. You want to get as many arm's length transactions as possible, see how the market is valuing properties of that type, find as many comparables, as they call them, for comparable properties, and look at what those properties are selling for, adjusting for differences in characteristics, and location being a key characteristic, of course. But by doing that, the market values give us a sense of the highest and best use of the property. This is a term that's used in the property world that reflects that the property is being put to its use, which generates the most net income and therefore makes the property most valuable. And so oftentimes it's the case that properties are being used in less than their highest and best use temporarily. Or you could imagine a situation where you've got an urbanized area and in the middle of high-rise buildings you've got a paved parking lot, which is clearly not highest and best use, but may temporarily just be a paved parking lot and will soon be developed into another high-rise commercial facility. And so its market value should reflect the use of that property, which would generate the greatest net income and therefore make the lot most valuable. Now, there are alternatives to using market value that are used by some states. And each of them, if you rely on an alternative measure of property value for your property tax system, each of them will distort land use and location of mobile capital in some way. And you may want or not want that distortion, but recognize that there will be distortions. My first example is the way California does it since Proposition 13. They've moved away from a traditional property tax altogether. It's still called a property tax, but technically speaking, it's not a property tax. It's an acquisition value tax. So you're taxed on the basis of the value of the property at the point at which you acquired the property. And then Proposition 13 limits the rate of growth in the assessment over time and also limits the rate of taxation on it. So it's a way to tax, but it's not a particularly fair way to tax. You'll find two homeowners in a community, identical homes side by side, one of whom has lived there for 30 years and pays very low taxes because the tax is based on acquisition value. The other one pays very, very high taxes because the property was acquired last year when the transaction price was very high. And so in terms of horizontal equity, treating people equally who are in equal situations, that is equal properties, similar properties, this way of taxing has very serious flaws if you care about that kind of equity. But nonetheless, the California courts have upheld Proposition 13, and California continues to tax on that basis. Because it involved a very substantial reduction in property taxes initially after Proposition 13 was passed, you should understand the context of the time, of course. This was the 1970s, and it was also a time when the state of California stepped in and began to fund local public services at a much higher level, schools especially. So there were, along with Proposition 13 came a transfer of responsibility for funding some local services like schools from local units, the communities, to the state. And now the state, more recently, is in the situation where it really can't sustain that level of funding, and per pupil funding for schools in California has declined quite substantially in more recent years, and school funding issues have become important policy issues in California. But it's all tied up with Proposition 13 and other changes that they made. We'll talk more about agricultural property later on, but at the same time, California passed the Williamson Act, which allowed use value assessment of agricultural property as well. So it's a complicated case, but I point it out because they use a very different standard of how to measure property value and its acquisition value. I don't recommend it, but it's an alternative that they continue to use. Current use value is another way to tax property, and it's used for agricultural property in many states. I'll have more to say about this in a little bit. I'm currently involved, as the introduction said, in doing some research on this for the Lincoln Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're currently writing a book, my co-author Richard Englund at the University of New Hampshire and I, all about use value assessment for rural lands, not only agricultural, but timberland and other forms of rural properties as well. So in this case, you're taxing not on the basis of highest and best use, market value, you're taxing on the basis of the property's current use, ignoring other potential uses if they are higher. And there may or may not be a difference. I'll have more to say about that in a little bit. So, continuing with the idea of the ideal tax base being the market value, it's important to think about the assessment administration as well. Every property tax system requires some kind of assessment system, it's the assessor who has the responsibility to value all the properties in the jurisdiction. It goes without saying that that has to be done accurately, has to be done fairly and done well. But the key issue I'd like to hone in on is the idea of the assessment ratio. This is the ratio between the assessed value of a piece of property and its market value. Okay? So if you're assessing at full market value, the assessed value is equal to the market value, this ratio is 1. If you're assessing at something less than full market value, the assessment ratio is less than 1. So R, this ratio, ranges from 0 to 1, depending on your assessment standard and how close to market value you're assessing the properties. When you've got a system like this, equalization processes are absolutely necessary for equity in the system, right? You can't have assessor in County A behaving differently from County B, while, you know, in an isolated circumstance, that might be all right. If the assessor under-assesses properties, that just means the rates have to be higher to generate the same amount of revenue. And you might say, well, so what? Let there be variation across counties for that purpose. The reason you can't do that is because there are complications like the school aid formula, which is based in part on property value per pupil. And so if you've got a local assessor sandbagging on valuations, so the property values are low per pupil there, the local school districts get more than their fair share out of the school aid formula. And so I'm sure you're well aware of this complication, but equalization is necessary in its own right to assure fairness across counties and local units. But it's also important when you look at the larger context of the way we fund schools and the school aid formula and any other kind of intergovernmental transfer that's based on property value makes the